You're listening to the Music Manumit Podcast for December 20th, 2010. Learn more at musicmanumit.com. Hi, and welcome to another Music Manumit. I'm Tom, and with me today is Doug.
Hello.
And we also have a guest today, Mr. Mike Nutt. Am I pronouncing that last name right?
Yeah, that's just like a Mike walnut, Nutt. Peanut. Yep,
nut. Nice. Yep. I was wondering if it was going to be like Newt, or it was going to have some sort of, pronunciation that I was unaware of, because...
Yeah, no, that would have made my early childhood a lot easier, probably, but no such luck on that.
Yeah, you could just put random characters at the beginning of it that are silent. Like, my girlfriend's last name is Nguyen. She's Vietnamese, and it looks like Nguyen. You could just, no, the Z and the Q are silent.
I could add, like, an umlaut or something, maybe?
Yeah, yeah.
There you go.
I'll look into that.
But I guess it would still be Nut either way when you said it.
I mean, deep in my heart, I'd always know that it was Nut, so...
Well, that's okay. Like, Colbert, he was a Colbert.
Yeah.
And then he decided for fame and fortune, it would be better to be Colbert. this is totally what we were planning on talking about. We're interviewing Mike about his name.
That's what all the questions are, is talk about your name.
Well, we'll go through the four letters in detail.
Well, I was thinking about releasing my last name under a Creative Commons license. So
I like that. Is it going to be non-commercial?
No, people can make money off of it. That's cool.
Okay, yeah.
But what about derivatives? Are you going to allow derivatives?
Definitely
no derivatives.
Okay. There you go.
I've got to protect the integrity of the original
the name.
Word.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right.
where are you located, Mike? Where are you hailing from these days?
I have lived in Carrboro for the last 10 years, Carrboro, North Carolina, which is, your listeners may be more familiar with Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The former home of Merge Records and the University of North Carolina is here. So Carrboro is kind of attached to Chapel Hill at the hip. You wouldn't even really be able to tell that it was a different town unless you knew that it was a different town. Carrboro, North Carolina.
Is the publishing company Chapel Hill actually based in Chapel Hill as well? Do you know?
I've
always wondered that.
I don't know.
Yeah, Chapel Hill used to do, they used to do work with, like, back in the 90s with, like, the Smashing Pumpkins, and they worked with Caroline Records and other things like that. And I always wondered if they were actually based in Chapel Hill or if they were just using the name.
So. I don't know. I mean, Doug, do you know? I mean, Doug hails from Chapel Hill. Well, I don't know if hails is the right word, but spent some time in Chapel Hill.
I lived in the Triangle for 9 years, and the Triangle is, like, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill. Carrboro doesn't get their fair shout in it, but
we're working on improving that.
It'll be like the I don't know. It certainly wouldn't be a square if Carrboro entered it. It would be like a triangle with a point on top.
Yeah.
So, there's an awesome video on YouTube that we should definitely put on in the show notes. That's called It's Carrboro.
I was thinking about that the other day. That video really is hilarious because it totally gets to the heart of what Carrboro stands for and is. It's really funny.
Yeah, I need to go turn that down on the other computer, or else everybody that listens to the podcast is gonna know when somebody in the world scores a goal. I assume you guys heard that because it was really loud.
This is obviously an inside joke that I'm not getting yet, so I'm going to have to watch that video later. I have no clue what you guys are talking
about. Well, it's not inside because it's on YouTube. But, So for people in Madison, which is probably, I don't know how many people listen in Madison, except obviously Tom's here, but if Willie Street were its own town, that's what Carrboro would be like.
Oh,
so,
all right. Nice.
So I'm gonna go mute that other computer. So
okay then.
Talk amongst yourselves.
Does he have a computer across the room or something? What just happened?
I don't know.
So what do you do, Mike? What is your major, like, what kind of projects and other things do you pass the time with?
So I guess my primary identity right now would have to be student. So I'm a student in the School of Information and Library Science at UNC. Mm-hmm. So figuring out how to be an information scientist is what I do with most of my time these days. But I've done some music things. I wouldn't necessarily call myself a musician per se, although I have, I've been in bands and I play guitar and that kind of thing. But in terms of actually producing audio, my focus has been kind of more on more experimental stuff. There's a few things that I have up on SoundCloud, but in terms of the arts, my experience is more kind of like really, what's the expression? It's a mile wide, an inch deep. I like to get my hands in lots of different kinds of things. So, I've done a little bit of video editing, a little bit of audio.
Well, a lot of that kind of goes hand in hand, too. I mean, knowing more about different areas, it all just kind of becomes helpful in different ways. Like if you're doing audio editing and then you move on over to video editing, it's kind of like, oh, well, I've kind of understand what's going on here, and you can, kind of just pick up from where you left off on the other sort of project. I know that.
Yeah, and the cool thing about audio, getting experience with audio is that, people are so visual that it's really interesting in terms of media production. Audio doesn't, there's some things about audio that people just don't get. You have to listen a lot harder to what's going on when you're recording music and audio, and it's not as intuitive, I think, for some people to pick up. So, the audio skills have definitely served me well in the other realms as well.
So, even though you claim not to be a musician, I think you have a history in we'll call it the music industry.
Yeah.
If you can call it that. And I don't, I assume you didn't cover this. If I did, you can just cut this out, Tom. But, but you used to work/intern at Merge.
Yeah.
And also you were a DJ at
XYC.
XYC, yeah.
Yeah.
I blanked there for a minute. And that was that particular radio station is interesting because it was the first online radio station.
Yeah, that's right. The first one to simulcast. I think that was for a while it was funny. I think it was disputed between, I think Georgia Tech wanted to take that.
Why is Georgia always trying to take our first in Chapel Hill?
Are there other things that they've tried to take?
Well, not Georgia Tech, but Georgia also claims to be the first state university.
Oh, that's right. And UNC wants that title. No, yeah, so it was kind of up in the air, but then probably 5 years ago, it was actually a question on Jeopardy. What was the first radio station to broadcast online? So, I think at this point we're kind of calling that settled. That WXYC was the triumphant one in that matchup. So I was a DJ at WXYC from probably 2002 to 2005, and I served on the management team there. And it's a really great station. So it's freeform. Which means different things to different stations, but XYC's take on that is kind of that, a bluegrass song might follow a hip-hop song, which might be followed by some noise, or free jazz. So literally from like one song to the next, you don't necessarily know what's coming next. Which is kind of a difficult thing to pull off, It was definitely tricky for me. It took me a long time to kind of make that work and be able to make songs flow from one to the next and still try to cover a whole lot of ground like that, as opposed to other free forum stations that may do a two-hour chunk of reggae followed by a two-hour chunk of blues or whatever.
Yeah, that doesn't sound very freeform to me.
Yeah, I mean...
And it's true. You're right. There are stations where they'll play a bunch of different stuff, but never like one right after the other. I never realized that before. That isn't freeform, is it?
Yeah. Well, it was something that was debated at the station quite a bit. Was this format, and a lot of people wanted to push towards having a kind of more blocky format where you have blocks of genres and call that freeform. Because it can be challenging to listen to that, honestly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't have a problem with that. I just think calling it freeform is misleading.
So, Mike, how did you guys do the simulcast? Like, did you use something like an Icecast, or did you just have a server that you guys made yourselves, or do you know how they actually broadcast it on the internet?
Well, it was largely through the help of iBiblio, actually. So there's kind of a free culture tie-in. I don't know if you're familiar with iBiblio or if your listeners are, but so iBiblio is kind of the world's one of the world's first online digital libraries, and I think they kind of build themselves as a library of libraries. So they collect a lot of different kinds of resources, a lot of texts, and
yeah.
Do you know, is that an accurate description, Doug? I don't know if I'm really doing that.
Yeah, and for some people that were in computing in the 90s, it used to be metalab.unc.edu, and before that it was sunsite.unc.edu. And I would bet money that it was not iBiblio at the time that it was streaming.
No, yeah, you're right about that. It wasn't.
So just so people, you know, if they're like, oh my God, I don't know what iBiblio is, you may well have heard of the other names of it.
Yeah, and I don't remember if it was MetaLab or SunSite at the time, but it was definitely one of those earlier
iBiblio hosts a lot of things that you might not know about. So in the music world, they host E-Tree, which is like the an online, or at least they used to. I think they may have moved to archive.org. I don't know how all of that is worked. Maybe archive.org is mirroring it now or something. But they used to do E-Tree, and they do Groklaw, which probably doesn't mean anything to anybody that's not.
It just kind of sounds like you made a noise. Groklaw.
Yeah. It's G-R-O-K. It's a Linux law. Started with the whole SCO fiasco. But there's a bunch of other sites that don't actually have the name iBiblio in it that, you know, down at the bottom probably have a little icon that says, you know, hosted at iBiblio or something like that. It's absolutely gigantic.
Right. I mean, XYC wouldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't for iBiblio. I mean, they totally took the lead on that. And I don't know exactly what the configuration was at the beginning, and you know, it's likely changed a couple times since then, but yeah, and as far as I know, they still handle the streaming.
Okay, so now that was sorry, I don't know if you can hear my dog freaking out at the mailman upstairs right now. So the you know, was I'm assuming an open source thing to use, and they allowed the iBiblio, or I guess the only background I have on iBiblio is that I know is it's one of the search choices in one of my browsers that you can use as a default.
Yeah, so iBiblio and XYC were both UNC, University of North Carolina institutions, and I think it was more just kind of that, you know, some people at iBiblio wanted to test this kind of technology, and they happen to have a radio station on campus, so it was like a natural fit.
Well, that's cool. So you guys got to help each other out in like, we want to do this, and you're like, well, we want to do this. Let's go.
Now that's kind of my understanding of it. I mean, the history. I mean, that was one thing that was interesting about working at WXYC was the you know, it's a student run radio station. I don't know if we mentioned that before, but it's at least to get hired at the station, you have to be a student. And so it was an interesting place because there wasn't a whole lot of institutional memory at WXYC. You know, there's a lot of turnover because students come and go. So it was actually kind of hard to get a historical perspective on the station. So questions like that, you know, like what the details of the original arrangement between iBiblio and XYC were. I mean, I'm sure, obviously, somebody knows what that was, but...
somebody was there.
Somebody was there, but...
So, now we talk, the show here itself, we talk a lot about Creative Commons and just kind of exposing the people the reasons that they should or at least consider using Creative Commons as far as protecting their things, but yet sharing it. What drew you to Creative Commons and being, you know, someone that's involved in Creative Commons and putting their work out there like that?
Yeah, I guess my first, when I first became aware of Creative Commons was when I was working in the, well, so I used to work in the Communication Studies Department at the University of North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
and it was the media production program, and I was basically helping kids make bad student movies was essentially what I did. I would kind of provided tech support. I would answer, you know, questions about how to work this or that piece of equipment. I was mainly working with the hardware side of things, so repairing video cameras and testing microphones and that kind of thing. So I managed the checkout room, and so I had a lot of interaction with students who were, you know, kind of making these various kinds of media projects. Like I said, primarily kind of video oriented program, but definitely some audio production stuff going on there too. You know, one thing that that was always kind of a difficult thing for students to grapple with was like the soundtracks and what to do for their soundtracks, because most of the students there are they're really focused on the cinematography and the videography and the editing, the video editing. Mm-hmm. But you know, then they have these finished movies and they need to score them, you know. And they wouldn't necessarily have, you know, friends that could just whip out a soundtrack for them. So I think I initially started getting interested in Creative Commons as a way to kind of, you know, show these kids that you could actually get music and soundtracks for free and legally, you know. Because, I mean, most of the time they would just throw in whatever their Blink-182.
Right.
Song underneath there and call it a day. So I was trying to, you know, raise awareness a little bit that, you know, you can't really do that when you get out in the real world. You need to think about how your soundtracks are going to be licensed and what your options are for that. So that, I think that was kind of my entree into Creative Commons was through that.
And over the years, it's actually gotten a lot easier to do that, because I've worked with people where they're like, oh, we need to find some music for this, and I would just go to archive.org, because that used to be the only place you could really search for licensed
right.
type stuff. But now it is so much easier with a bunch of sites that are supporting it, like you know, Free Music Archive and Jamendo, and
yeah.
like it's gotten way better to be able to prove that
yeah.
point, because what you used to have to do is you'd have to search forever for anything that was remotely close to what you were looking for.
Oh yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And that's the
quality.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, and the
yeah.
quality, because that was the good and the bad thing about archive.org is that anybody can upload something there and they can put any keywords
right.
in they want. It kind of muddies the waters when you're looking for something specific. So.
Yeah, and it was, you know, it was difficult to convince students that was even something that you know, they should be paying attention to. And then, you know, if I could get students to use Creative Commons stuff, it was it was mostly a quality issue. It was like, well, that's not what I need for my piece, you know, like
mm-hmm.
why should I be forced to use that when that's not what I want creatively? So the kind of proliferation of like you said, the availability of Creative Commons licensed stuff has made that kind of much more feasible, I think, for a student perspective on that anyway.
Right. So what's your license of choice?
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about Creative Commons stuff these days. I mean, I you know, for my own, the few things that I release, you know, like the things that I have up on SoundCloud, you know, I'm all the way, whatever, remix it, make money off of it. It doesn't really matter to me, because that's not, I mean, I'm not even, you know, pushing myself as a creative source of whatever sound. If that makes sense, it doesn't matter to me what happens to those tracks, and if somebody can do something with them, then that's probably better for me.
Well, that's interesting, because the actual SoundCloud license that you've got is the non-commercial license.
Oh, is it really? Oh,
yeah.
That's unintentional. Maybe that's what is. Does it default to that? I don't know if I.
It may.
I would assume the default was all rights reserved, but.
Oh, really?
I don't know. That's just what I would assume.
Well, yeah, that's not necessarily, that's not
so
intentional.
Exclusive so exclusive to Music Manumit listeners, do what the hell you want with.
We broke the story. Look out, WikiLeaks, we're coming.
yeah. I'm going to put you guys on the map.
I mean, if you did have something, or if you had to recommend to somebody, you know, what type of license they should do, or when you were talking with students and how to use Creative Commons music with their films and things like that, what would you steer them towards?
So that's a good question, because I mean, you know, what I do with my stuff is obviously different than what maybe it's not obvious, but I think that it is different than kind of the things that students need to consider. And I mean, my experience with the students was kind of trying to find them material to work with. In terms of them licensing their own stuff, I think that's a little bit different, and it's, you know, it's hard to make blanket statements, I think, about what licenses you should use. I don't know if one size fits all for everybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, it does for the small amount of things that I'm releasing. Again, because, you know, my primary identity right now isn't a creative producer. But for students, I don't know. You know, it's kind of a tough question, because they're, it's not likely that they're going to be making a lot of money off of the stuff that they make in college, or that it even has the potential to do that, right? I mean, they're still learning. The quality is going to be fairly low, and what they're, you know, what's probably going to be more useful to them is just the free advertising that you would get with a Creative Commons license.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one thing that I was going to ask specifically about, because I know, I don't know, Tom, did you read Mike's art? I guess it's an article. Is that what you would call a piece in a zine?
Yeah.
And it's titled, "The Creative Commons License is for Rich People." So I guess by Mike's definitions, you're rich, Tom.
Really? Am I now?
Yeah. No, not exactly. But so this is an interesting sort of thing, and I mentioned to Mike that Lorenzo's Music, Tom's band, has sold more albums. I guess you still call them albums. Mm-hmm. Now that it's Creative Commons, then you had... beforehand, and if I'm not mistaken, even more since you moved to BYSA instead of the non-commercial license. Is that accurate?
I don't think the actual, like, going from the non-commercial to BYSA has changed too much, but ever since we have done Creative Commons and also just kind of free to download, we have sold a lot more, even through iTunes, rather than just what we used to get.
Now, that's an interesting thing as well with the iTunes, because I guess at that point you're sort of dual licensing mm-hmm. things, because iTunes doesn't allow Creative Commons, as far as I'm aware.
Well, you can put it as a footnote.
That's true.
And that's true. Kind of what we've done. But essentially, it's a package deal with the CD creation company that we use, with CD Baby. And they automatically submit your album to iTunes, and it just kind of gets put there.
You know, because there was this whole thing with the Apple Store and GPL'd software, but I guess that was because there's so many different people that have copyrights on the software, and you have to get them all to agree to the terms of service in the App Store. Whereas with your band, there's what, five guys that have the copyrights? Is that? How many people?
We have five now. We used to have
five.
Eight.
Yeah, so only five people have to agree that it's cool if it's on iTunes. So that's a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. but anyway, sorry to steer us off track on that. But anyway, your response to that, Mike, was correlation is not causation, which of course it's not. but would you? I mean, do you think that's what it was, Tom? That you were just able to get more, you know, more people were able to listen to your stuff, and therefore, the percentage of people that listen to your stuff that bought things may have actually decreased, but the overall number increased, which is what presumably, if you're trying to make money, you actually care about.
I would
about.
Say a lot of it has to do with buyer's guilt. You know, like
Well, that's really I'm glad that you brought that up. Sorry.
No, that's quite all right.
But yeah, that's well, I think that the buyer's guilt is actually kind of an impulse that should probably be exploited a little bit more, and I think we can.
That's such a terrible term, Mike.
Yeah, I know it is. Well, you know, to call it buyer's guilt is putting a negative spin
that's,
on it. I mean,
that's true.
I think you can put a positive spin on it and say that
people aren't always dicks.
That's much more positive. Thank you.
No, they're pretty much always dicks, and you have to find ways to get around that. I think is the reality of the situation. But no, so like I just recently found out about this the creator endorsed license from you guys actually, which I guess you mentioned a little bit a few shows mm-hmm. ago.
So I just want to say that was literally the next question on our list.
Well, I think it ties into this because what we were calling buyer's guilt a minute ago is actually, you know, kind of a feeling of it gets a little mushy here, but you know, charity or you know, wanting to help out somebody who has made a piece of you know, something creative. I think you can harness that better if you make it explicit that the money would benefit, you know, a real person instead of BMG or Sony Records or whatever.
Yeah.
So if you can communicate that to, you know, your potential audience that, look, if you pay for this, it's really going to help me out, or, you know, the person who made this could really use the money and it would really, you know, pay their light bill or whatever and not go into buying a stretch Hummer or something. So, you know, I love the idea of the creator endorsed icon, and I want to check it out a little bit more. I literally just found out about it this morning.
Yeah, and so. we have just found out about it like maybe a month ago, if that. So it's a new thing to me too, and I think it's brilliant. I think it's really important to show what is the most valuable as far as buy this, whereas the other one is like, this is being put out and I'm barely getting anything for it, so if you buy this, you know, please buy this other thing or donate. Or I just think that it's really good to, because everybody always puts out the statistics like, oh, this much, you know, buy it from iTunes so the artist gets revenue. Yeah, you get like you know, part of a cent on a 99 cent download. It doesn't do anything. So I think it's good to show where it most importantly comes from. Is that a sentence? That's a sentence.
Yeah.
Okay.
yeah. And I mean the thing about the Creative Commons license is two things. So I'm not arguing for digital rights management. You know, I'm not arguing for any kind of technology that would impede the sharing of any digital object, because I think that for the most part that's either going to make it inconvenient for the person who actually has the digital objects, you know, they won't be able to copy it or whatever, and then there, you know, are accessibility issues with digital rights management software. So I'm not arguing that we should lock down our digital files or make them not shareable, but I do think that we can, you know, kind of develop new tools for, or new licenses or new brands for licenses that encourage economic development. And the Creative Commons license doesn't, you know, it has a lot of good points, but it does not. It's not designed to encourage economic development, and I think that they're, and the cool thing about the creator endorsed license is that it's kind of meant to be used in conjunction with the Creative Commons license. So I think that that's kind of a pretty powerful combination to combine the two. You know, like you can share it, but hey, you know, it'd be cool if you paid for it because the person could use the money too.
Yeah, I got a couple things. That go off of that. The one is back to the sort of feeling sorry for the person or buyer's guilt or whatever. Right. I mean, is that really sort of a brand loyalty thing? And then I guess on top of that question, Mike, if you want to speak to the co-op that you mentioned in your article and whether it's still going and the progress that you've made in that. Those two.
Yeah, well, the, you know, what the Creative Commons is, license has been really successful in is creating a brand, and they're, you know, they will freely admit that, you know, it's been a very big branding success. I mean, people know what the Creative Commons license is now.
Well, I don't mean as far as the Creative Commons. I mean as far as, like, to an artist. You know, people buy Apple products because they have brand loyalty to Apple. So if you're a Lorenzo's Music fan, you know, yeah, or a Mike Nutt fan, then you might have some brand loyalty to the Mike Nutt brand, and therefore want to purchase goods. And in that sense, it's not really, I don't think it's really buyer's guilt as much as it is sort of a, it's sort of a proactive thing. I mean, I guess in some ways it's sort of a donation, you know, like they were saying. But I don't know that it's necessarily feeling sorry for them. It's more of a, if you want this artist to continue making music, you know that they have to have money. And to me, that's not an issue of feeling sorry for something. That's an issue of you want more, and therefore you're willing to support it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's not that the... right, I mean, the listener or the potential buyer is getting something out of the transaction, right? I mean, they're getting a piece of music or whatever.
It's like an investment, really.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. And, you know, the other thing is, so individual, you know, loyalty to an individual entity or band, I think that's important, but I think that you could also approach it in the same way that, you know, what I'd like to see is a buy local movement attached to media, you know, buy local media. Hmm. I know that, you know, people in Carrboro are willing to pay, you know, $5 for a pound of tomatoes at the farmer's market down the street because they know that, you know, they have a relationship with the person, they can talk to them, they know where the food came from. And that's not something that has really been exploited, I think, in music or digital media in general. You know, I think that you could really kind of capitalize on a buy local media movement so that you're not so that you just, you know, consume more of the media that's being produced around you.
Now, I want to come back to the co-op thing, but once again, like, we did not give you access to our question list, did we? Because that was literally the next question, and that's something that we always ask people, is what is the Creative Commons culture like in your region? And almost always they're kind of like, eh, there's not a lot of people doing it. So that may be a hindrance to the sort of buy local movement, is if you don't know that who the other Creative Commons artists are in your area, then it's hard to do that. I mean, we have really one band in Madison that's doing Creative Commons, and then there's one guy that released a track, as far as I'm aware, and then there's like one in Milwaukee and a few in Chicago.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I guess it depends on what you define as local. But,
sure. Well, I mean, I wonder, you know, if all those people would be willing to set up a website with each other and say, you know, make a hub for other people to come. And yeah, sure, initially it might not be all that big, but if you had a local website where you could go to buy local digital media, I mean, that's kind of the idea behind the co-op that I'm interested in starting, that is mentioned in the Creative Commons is for Rich People article, which is intentionally provocatively titled. I realize that's yeah. I mean, obviously it's not just for rich people, but you know, I was trying to get some eyeballs with that.
I would agree with what you're saying about the you know, when Doug said that it's, you know, there's only a couple around, but I would say that that's could be turned into a positive. And I was going to say pretty much what you just did, is that they should really seek each other out and expose that, hey, you should go check out this person. Like, you know, when I've heard of somebody locally around here that does it, I've always reached out to them and said, hey, how you doing? We release our music this way too and stuff. And, you know, spoken to a couple of people that way, or even in different states. Even through this show, it was one of the whole concepts of doing this show, was just to kind of meet the people that are actively using it instead of just seeing it online and going, oh, cool.
Yeah.
You know, and What you're talking about is it kind of like, for lack of a better way of putting it, a Craigslist sort of thing for this, where you have the one place you go and it's kind of split up by region, but you can still see everybody, but you could like look in your section of the world and see who's doing it there?
So I'm starting a business, and what that business is going to look like is still up in the air. It's likely going to be a hybrid for-profit, non-profit model. But what I'd like to do is to have a cooperative social network site. So imagine that you were a part owner in YouTube, and that YouTube was based in your town, and it had a community center attached to it. So that's kind of the idea that I'm working with. So I'm exploring the possibility of having a community-owned social network site in Orange County. Just as kind of an arbitrary geographical limiter.
We should clarify that's Orange County, North Carolina, where
Orange County,
Chapel
North Carolina, right, exactly, where Chapel Hill and Carrboro are. Because I think there's a lot of opportunity to kind of, to go back to the buyer's guilt thing. We got to figure out a better term for that. It's not but to go back to that idea, I think there's a lot of opportunity there to kind of reinforce what happens online with what happens in your physical world and your real community that we haven't really tapped yet as much as we should. So, when I envision this now, I think of it more as just, one site that doesn't have any kind of subdivisions or anything, that is just for Orange County. And if you want to buy digital media in Orange County, from people that made it, that live in Orange County, you would go to this one website. And, hopefully we could provide a model for other people to copy. I would love for our model to be open source so that people could duplicate it in other places.
Yeah, I like that idea.
So that's kind of the basic idea behind it. And, this is kind of not as much related to Creative Commons or digital media, but there's when you're on Facebook, you're donating a lot of information to Facebook. They're making a lot of money off of you, and I think that should probably be a community-owned resource. If our information is going to be digitized or monetized, then I think that money should probably go back to the people who who made the information. So that's the other kind of the other part of the monetization strategy for this community-owned social network site.
Nice.
I'm not actually sure if I asked the direct question, but what is sort of the landscape of things, broadly in the region? Are there a lot of people doing Creative Commons or not so much?
My impression is that there are a fair number of people doing it, and I think that probably has something to do with the fact that the universities in the area seem to be invested one way or another in the idea of free culture, certainly, and the Creative Commons license specifically. We were talking about iBiblio earlier, and Paul Jones, who started iBiblio and still runs it, is a big supporter of the Creative Commons license, and has hosted events like getting DJ Shadow to come and talk to people about the practice of sharing and sharing music and free culture. And there's a professor at Duke University, which is down the road in Durham, Durham, North Carolina, that James Boyle, who I want to say he's like a board member of Creative Commons, or said, don't quote me on that. I might be making that up, but anyway, he's a lawyer, and he studies Creative Commons stuff, and Duke has a whole center for intellectual property studies or something like that. I'm getting really fuzzy here on the details, but I think it's fairly strong. The number of people, so what I'm saying is, like, people talk about it. I see it, in the news or around campus. I see different things related to Creative Commons. How many people are actually using it for their own work? It's kind of harder to say. Things like SoundCloud becoming more popular recently, I think, are giving more visibility to people who are using Creative Commons licenses. I'm friends with a few people who have stuff on SoundCloud that are licensed.
It's crazy how that's gotten so popular, isn't it?
You know, I think
that, I mean, SoundCloud's been around for, yeah, I want to say maybe almost 2 years now. And all of a sudden, boom, like it's everywhere. Like everybody's using SoundCloud. There's the SoundCloud login that you can do on some sites that use it exclusively. And the fact that they are still gearing towards more and more making sure that stuff is visibly Creative Commons based, if you want to use that, and they're adding it in their players, and just it seems like they're really staying on topic with what they started out saying they were going to do, yeah. And I admire that, but it's crazy how it's everywhere now.
Yeah, well, they nailed the interface, didn't they? I mean, it's so you can embed the tracks, and it's just like it's really fun to interact with, you know, like. Mm-hmm. I love the waveform interface. I think that was kind of a stroke of genius to give users something visual to latch onto.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think I would agree with that. And I thought the first thing that was cool about it too was the inline commenting.
Mm-hmm.
The way that you can comment directly in there and go, I love this part.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, there it is. That's the part. And you can look through and say, that's a very good point, is the more visual and like it's an interactive player.
Yeah, big SoundCloud fan for sure.
Before we move on to the next question or the next sort of one we have written down, when I was reading the... basically the article before, you know, in preparation for the interview, a thought occurred to me that maybe at least one of the things that you're trying to accomplish that's making money could be at least partially done by dual licensing, like doing two different Creative Commons licenses. And so you could release things as the BYNCSA so people can't make derivatives without it being non-commercial, and you could also do a no derivatives but not use the NC, which would mean that people could play things just like at a grocery store or something, as long as they didn't make a derivative, say a movie or a commercial. I think those are the two big ones. Then that they would be able to play the music, and therefore, obviously, it's with attribution, so it's kind of like free advertising for you. Do you think that's a model that could work, or is it something you just have to kind of think about?
I'm going to have to listen to this podcast and try to unravel what you just said there. But
let me say, I guess this type of thing that I guess I'm getting at is, if basically people want to be able to share, but they don't want to be taken advantage of. Essentially, that's sort of the thing that people hear, you know. So they don't necessarily mind if a DJ is making money at a party and plays their song. Now that's prohibited by the non-commercial license. So what Headphonica does, and I don't know if you went back and listened to that interview, but what they do is they say explicitly on their site that, you know, DJs that are doing live performances, that it's okay for them to play their music and get paid. They're essentially dual licensing that stuff, but it's not sort of built in. I mean, there's no way when their stuff gets put on Jamendo or something like that, it's not easy. It's not searchable. For them to be able to found, like if a DJ goes to Jamendo and they want stuff that they can use commercially, they're not going to find the Headphonica stuff, even though Headphonica would be fine if they did. There's been some calls to sort of get rid of some of the Creative Commons licensings because it's confusing. But I think that it would be better if they had some more granularity, or maybe something like a sub-license, which would be a little bit different than the dual license that I'm talking about now. So it would be like, it would be simply a license that was like BYNCSA Live. you know, like plus live. And so, you know, the average quote-unquote consumer can see BY and CSA, and they can go sort of, they don't have to think about it any more than that. But then sort of the prosumer slash, you know, professional grade person who really wants to do something with it, they get a little more information. I mean, I think the problem is that sort of people that are dinking around can get confused. You know, people that aren't necessarily super familiar with things. And I do see that as being a problem. I mean, because it should be accessible to sort of the naked eye. But I don't see why there's any reason that people that spend a lot of time dealing with music can't sort of click another box to say, oh, yeah, that's really what I'd like to do. I don't know how you feel about, you know, whether the stuff is confusing or if any of that would. I think it was the last show that Tom and I recorded. Yeah. I sort of threw that out there, not fully baked. And I thought about it some more after that and was like, that could work. So
to something that it is a little confusing. And, you know, I don't know what the solution to that is, because there are a lot of things to consider in licensing and using licensed stuff. So, you know, the Creative Commons has been successful in kind of creating a brand that is about sharing. I mean, I think people get that. I mean, I guess what I'd like to do, and I don't know what if this means to that we'd have to have dual licensing, or if we need to adjust the Creative Commons, or maybe, you know, the other one, that the creator endorsed thing is the answer. But what I really want to see is that anytime somebody shares or uses a piece of digital work, they think about whether or not the person who made that work could use some money. And if they, you know, share or publish or play that, that piece, that they've, you know, given the artist a tip, you know, something. I don't know what the mechanism. I don't know what the mechanism for that is, or what, you know, what that would look like. But that's kind of what I'd like to see. You know, if the artist wants that, you know, of course there's going to be plenty of people. You know, like my stuff on SoundCloud, I don't need any money for that. You know, it doesn't.
Right.
That's just not important to me. But if
it
kind of
sounds like you're talking about situational licensing too, when you say like the dual licensing. Like, if you intend to do it for this, please use this one. Otherwise, if you're just a person listening to my stuff, use this one, or here's this one.
Well, I think the non-commercial tag does that sort of automatically. I mean, without saying that, if you have a no derivatives but don't also put the non-commercial on there, it's clear, at least to me, that that's the one that you should be using for commercial purposes. And then if there's a share-alike license with the non-commercial on it, then that one would be
free.
But
what I think he's talking about is passing along the original, you're on there, support the artists, and this much goes to the artists. When it goes to someone else, they just throw the license on it, and they know that they're using it properly, but they have no idea what's going back to the original artist.
Oh, that's, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think that's what the, so I mean, it would be, in that sense, I guess the creator endorsed mark along with the dual license. At least in my head, that's what I'm thinking. I mean, it's clearly a complicated sort of, you know, I mean, just the idea of sharing things but also getting paid. I mean, it's clearly there is some disconnect between those two. But one thing that Professor Click does, and again, I don't know if you went back and listened to the show that we did with Dan Castellas, which is basically Click's manager. But what he does is he actually releases his Creative Commons work with no sort of intention of making money at all. But he sort of uses it to promote himself as like a jingle writer. And I may be doing him a disservice by saying jingles, but he sort of works commercially in music, and sort of in his Creative Commons work is sort of for fun slash as an advertising thing. And also, of course, there's the whole sort of like, playing live sort of thing, you know, that model where people can make money from that. And so that's, two situations that are very different, but are ways in which people can make money and still not sort of make money by selling the digital good itself. I mean, is that something that you know people have experimented with, or
experimented with?
Well, like you personally, I mean, like your friends personally. Like, I know that Professor Click's doing that. Are there other people that are doing that you know about? Is that sort of a novel thing that he's doing?
Oh, so like using Creative Commons work to kind of support a different your day job or whatever?
Yeah.
No, that's very cool. I will have to go back and listen to that. That sounds very interesting. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head. But you know, it sounds like a doable thing. I mean, I guess my concern is you know, thinking about something like the live issue, you know, like making all your digital stuff free in order to advertise for your live performances. I mean, my concern about that is, you know, what if the Beatles had done that, you know, they didn't ever play live, you know, like all they had was recorded material. So you know, if you're setting up a model where you have to play live in order to support your digital recordings, I don't know if I'm a big fan of that, because you know, what if you just can't play live, or what if you don't want to play live?
Yeah, no, I understand that, but that's not. I mean, the Beatles did play live some, at least early on.
Well, early on,
they played all the time. If I remember correctly, they like lived in Germany for a while and basically played.
And that was before that they. I don't even know if they had released anything at that point.
Right.
But yeah, they were totally like German nihilists or something.
That's the breaking story of this podcast, is that the Beatles were German nihilists.
Well, they I mean, there was some sort of like German scene that was sort of dark that they were involved in, wasn't there?
Yeah, no, there.
And that was when there was the fifth Beatle in the band, and he was like an artist or something, and he's kind of the one that drove them more towards
the rest of the Beatles are totally not artists.
No, not at all. Yeah, at least not until they got on iTunes. Now they're artists.
Yeah, they would go to like CD clubs in Hamburg and stuff, and you know, do amphetamines and that kind of thing, I think. But you know, they didn't release anything after, say, like Rubber Soul, or they didn't play live after maybe 1966 or something. So
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So
right.
The most creative part of their career wasn't supported by performing live. And of course, they're, you know, they're a special case, but.
I had another sort of question, I guess, before what I guess are kind of wrap-up questions. But you mentioned that the FMA, I guess, I don't know if it was Jason specifically that contacted you, or if it was the people that were doing the Chapel Hill collection.
Yeah.
But if you could speak to that just a little bit. And oh, and the other question is whether or not you – have listened to the Gray Area podcast at all?
No. Uh-uh.
Do you know about that? So that's the podcast that Jason, I don't know his last name, but Jason from FMA has started doing like in mid-October. And he had a guest on. I don't remember which one. I think it was, the name of the show was like Art versus Content. And so they talked a lot, obviously, about art and content in that one. But I think that's the one where they talked about sort of lifestyle brands. So like Converse has a studio in Brooklyn that and I talked about, and like Mountain Dew has their thing.
Right.
So of course they want sort of those artists to, you know, they want to be able to use that stuff.
Yeah.
But I wonder, you know, there could be conceivably ways to do this sort of lifestyle branding, and still release works as Creative Commons. I mean, obviously, like your shows could be supported by Mountain Dew, and then they sell Mountain Dew at those shows. But then the recordings could still be Creative Commons. I mean, there would be. I don't know that like the big names would be interested in that sort of things, but there could be local.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of a brand that, you know, like a clothing brand in Chapel Hill or something. Or let's just say Weaver Street Market. Mm-hmm. There's a folk artist. That's what I associate with Weaver Street. People can flame me about that if they want.
Which is a cooperative grocery store.
Yeah. So it'd be like the Willie Street Co-op for the Madison folk. If they wanted to sort of have a lifestyle brand, yeah. which essentially they do. Yeah. I mean, it's not branded as such, but they have that brand identity. If they wanted sort of an artist to be the Weaver Street Market artist, I mean, that's sort of a special case because of what they do, you know, as far as sort of being, for lack of a better word, like a hippie place. You know, I think Creative Commons would fit in with that. But I don't see why there's any reason why necessarily a company would have a problem with them releasing recorded material as Creative Commons and still just sort of playing at their places, or if they played like at the Cat's Cradle, which is another local Carboro venue, you know, that was sort of branded as, you know, Mike Nutt brought to you by Weaver Street Market.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's something that you've thought about.
I think that's a great idea, and it's kind of you know what it is really is kind of going back to a patron model,
which
existed for hundreds of years in the arts, you know, where you had some kind of rich benevolent king or whatever that, you know, paid you to go compose classical music, you know, like you got a gig to go make a piece of art. You know, they'd want a picture of his dog and you'd go paint it for him or, you know, whatever. I think there's a lot of potential in that model for sure. And, you know, if people are going to share your music regardless, you know, which is going to happen sometimes, regardless of what your desires are. I mean, if you can somehow capture the value up front from somebody else in that kind of way, I think that's a fantastic model. Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, back to the FMA stuff. Sorry to sidetrack that with the podcast mentioned, but.
So this is kind of funny. I emailed the person who was. Who I was in contact with at the Free Music Archive to kind of get an update on the project. And he was kind of like, yeah, don't talk about that on the podcast. Because So WFMU wants to do like kind of a large donation to the FMA, I think, of... And I'm trying to walk carefully here. I think they want to donate some XYC recordings to the FMA that include the showcase thing that I was a part of. So I made a track that's actually a version of it is on SoundCloud right now, and it won this competition that was held. A year ago, the WXYC put on to...
That's our top tag for the show, Tom. Sorry to interrupt, Mac, but... Ms. Emanuel, which award-winning artist, Mike Nutt.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's hilarious. So anyway, it was like... they wanted to... What was it called? The Locally Produced Electronic Music Showcase, I think, is what it was called. And so they put out a call for people in the Chapel Hill area to submit electronic music that they had created. And so I submitted something that I made on, I think, Cakewalk or something, like in 2001.
Nice.
I mean, this was like way...
Yeah, I haven't heard that in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, this was way back in the day when, you know, I just... It was kind of my first experience with digital music, I think, or with digital recording.
Wow, you picked a great program to use for your first experience. Cakewalk is a beast.
I think it might have been like a junior version of Cakewalk. It was based on Cakewalk. It was maybe another product by them.
I like how you said junior version because I instantly thought that there were like pictures of like Dora the Explorer and SpongeBob on it, like the little kids' version.
Music. Somebody needs it. Yeah. Oh man, you should start a business with that idea.
I will.
So anyway, I submitted this track and it won, And there were, or it was one of maybe 10 or 15 pieces that were featured in this showcase. And I tried to find it recently on the XYC website, which they redesigned recently, and I couldn't find the list of tracks. They used to all be downloadable from the WXYC website. I'll look around and see if I can find that. Maybe you can put a link on the website if it still exists. But anyway, so XYC, I think, wants to kind of donate those to the FMA, but the process of moving slowly, I guess. So, I guess that's probably all I should say about that. Apparently.
Fair enough.
But
yeah. That's pretty cool, though.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, it was, you know, it was nice to be invited to participate in that. And, you know, I'm looking at the Free Music Archive release form. That was kind of interesting to see what they, you know, what that process is like. And it's pretty straightforward. I mean, everything, or the release form says that, you know, it's attribution, non-commercial, share alike is what they license everything automatically, I guess.
Do you spend a lot of time on Free Music Archive?
I haven't in the last, like, month or so, just because I've been so insane with school. Mm. But, yeah, before that, I was listening to it quite a bit. I mean, I think the cool thing with them is the curation aspect,
yeah,
which gets to the quality concerns that we had mentioned earlier, you know, trying to get students to use Creative Commons music and not seeing the quality being there.
Mm-hmm.
So having that, you know, kind of having those gatekeepers say, like, look, this is really good stuff, you know, I think that's the kind of cool part of the FMA.
What are some of your favorite artists that you've found on there that you could think
oh,
of?
Oh, Lord, no. man, what was, there was a, like I DJ, like a party DJ, I'm DJ Scrubbin' Bubbles.
Oh, nice. I like that.
Is my DJ name. So, you know, I was trying to, find, you know, some more dance, related stuff. And, they had a really nice mix of like, they called it like an exercise mix or something. That I really like.
I've actually seen that.
You know what I'm talking about?
On there.
Yeah, it was like a compilation of like 15 different artists or something. I liked that a lot.
So we've kind of left our DJ names off the. We've kind
oh,
of
yeah,
forgotten about
have.
That, Tom. But I think we have another DJ name now. Clearly, so a real DJ name. So that was something that. Well, we shouldn't go too much into that, but basically as sort of an award for people that contribute to the podcast, we decided we would give them an honorary DJ name. So I don't think we ever came up with one for Tom, but I'm DJ Dougie Death, and then Dan Costales was DJ Tanner.
Which I always thought was funny. But it turns out there is a DJ called DJ Tanner, and it's a girl somewhere in the world. I looked it up, but still, brilliant name.
Yeah.
Are there any artists or people involved in the Creative Commons community that you think, like, do you have any suggestions of people we could talk to or think people that you think are really doing some good work out there that we might not know about that you could turn us on to?
So when I was asking my contact, you know, what the status of this FMA thing
does
was,
he talk to you in his real voice? I mean, it sounds like, you know, maybe
like
there's a vocoder.
He's got, like,
I mean,
the deep throat,
like,
thing going on. Meet me at the internet.
Yeah.
Wow, that was creepy.
Yeah,
what I just did. That was fun. Yeah.
Sounded like Gollum.
No,
do you contact Gollum at the FMA? Is that
Gollum is way into the Creative Commons license? You'd be surprised. Yeah. No. So it was the old station manager of WXYC was the one that was kind of working at the. He did an internship up there with WFMU, and he was one that was in contact with me about the FMA stuff. So I think that he would David Van Duckham is his name, and he would probably be somebody that would be, you know, interesting to talk to in terms of kind of a behind the scenes, you know, what happens with the WFMU FMA stuff. He would probably be really interesting to talk to, and he actually suggested that you guys get in touch with Jason Siegel.
Okay.
I guess who is?
I think that's on Tom's
yeah, it actually
to-do
is.
List. I mentioned it anyway, so
yeah. So, you know, that's he's not in the area, but Yeah, I feel like you guys should talk to David. I think he'd probably be interesting. He was kind of deferred to Jason, but you might be able to talk him into doing that. And Paul Jones, maybe? I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I talked to Paul about doing that. Actually, he was my master's thesis advisor. I don't know if if you're in that far into it yet.
Yeah, he's.
I guess
too,
are you
actually.
Supposed to? Oh, interesting. Yeah.
You kids and your book learning.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Paul Jones is an interesting guy when it comes to book learning. I don't mean that in a negative way at all, but he is not the prototypical professor by any stretch.
No.
Is that fair to say, Mike?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And again, this is the guy that started iBiblio.
Yeah.
But, also down here, the guy that I mentioned, James Boyle in the Duke Law School, he does some really cool stuff. Like, I'm looking at his website right now, and so it's the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at the Duke Law School is what he heads up, and they've done cool stuff. Like, they put out a comic book that was called Bound by Law, Tales from the Public Domain. That was, like a comic book to explain, fair use, mm-hmm. essentially. I thought that was pretty cool. In terms of music stuff, I don't know. I'd have to think about that.
I just wanted to get, and we talked a lot about making money, but it doesn't sound like any of us really think like we have the solution. I guess you kind of have to try it before you know that you have the solution, or a solution, a real solution. None of us really know if stuff's going to work or not. But just what is your advice? Like, if somebody walked up to you on the street and was like, Mike, what should I do right now today to try to make money with Creative Commons? What would you tell them?
Well, I think for me, the basis of trying to make money through digital media or trying to use that as a tool for economic development comes down to community. So what I'd really like to see is people just kind of interacting more with the people that they're consuming the media of. That was, try to diagram that sentence, that was poorly worded.
But that sounds like it's from the, and maybe I guess you could do it some from the producer, that's the, from the
right,
artist
sure,
side.
Yeah, the producer,
but I mean, that's so. Partially on the listeners. So I guess in that vein, how would an artist, how would they go about forming those communities? Because obviously it takes two to tango, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I think that you've got to, I think you really have to start finding ways for producers to empower their consumers to communicate about their products, like through social media, essentially. I mean, my big interest over the last couple of years has been social media and trying to find ways to gel online community through different kinds of social media. So,
So you think people should communitize the community?
something like that, I think some of it is on the listener, but, the producer has to be really proactive about making sure that they're open to interaction with their listeners. That is how you build a personal brand, is through kind of cultivating those kinds of things. I see people like Diplo. I don't think he's necessarily released anything under Creative Commons, but he's really active on Twitter, and he's like constantly talking to his fans and getting them to submit various things, send me your Tumblr website, and I'm gonna pick the 50 hottest girls, and then I'll make a list of my 50 hottest Tumblr fans, which is something that he did recently. I think part of it is on the artist or the producer to provide ways for that community space to happen, because it's not gonna happen
right.
accidentally. So, if you can create a community space around your products, then I think that that's the way to start.
Just thinking about that, and actually, because I said communitize the community, which is not something I came up with, I think you might be interested in looking at the Severed Fifth project, because that's what they're all about. Now it's a metal band, so you might not be all into the music, it's a really interesting story that they've got, and I guess the only other thing that I'll mention about it is that the lead singer in the band and the guy that started the project is actually the community manager for the Ubuntu Linux distribution. So he wrote a book about community, so presumably he knows something about community, and he's trying to do that with his band. I can't really say that I know a whole lot about what they're doing, but it might be something that that you would like to look into.
Severed what?
Severed Fifth. F-I-F-T-H, so like vodka or Jack or
I always
something.
Think it's filth. When you say it, I always think, or like even when I read it, I always think it says Severed Filth. I don't know why.
and I believe they're just Severed
like
Fifth.
Like I've just taken that filth right off of me. I've severed it. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, that makes about as much sense as Severed Fifth, I guess.
Yeah, I think, but a fifth is a musical term.
It can be.
Can you have a severed fifth?
I don't know, but, and I don't know where that's where it came from, but that's where what I always thought, is that it, like, the dissonance of metal and stuff, like, you've got a fifth and then you're severing it in some way. I don't know. Maybe there's... I should ask my dad. He's the music theory professor. I'm sure severed fifth is not a technical term, but maybe there is some technical term that that severed fifth is a play on, a more brutal term.
I just had a vision of Doug Whitfield's magic guitar technique instructional book, you know, like Mel Bay's How to Play the Banjo, except it's Doug talking about severed fifths. Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Also, speaking of communities and stuff and getting stuff out there and finding places to put it, is there any, as we wind things down here, is there anything you'd like to promote or, you know, tell people to check out or places on the net that they should go for something you want to promote?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for that opportunity. So I started a student group at UNC that is dedicated to media literacy at the school and in the surrounding community. I hope that we can provide a model for other students who are interested in media literacy to adopt. So that might be of interest to some of your listeners, because I think that there's still a lot of work to be done for media literacy efforts. And so that website is uncstorylab.org, and then I'll mention one other thing, which is trying to get this cooperative social network site off the ground. We're starting with a kind of collaborative research project, just to try to make sure that this idea is grounded in best practices and solid research. And that's at communitycollecting.web.unc.edu. So that may be of interest. Actually, that entire...
What was that again? Community Collecting.
Communitycollecting.web.unc.edu. And that entire site is licensed with Creative Commons, so hopefully people will adapt that model as well.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see how that one plays out. I like the idea behind that, and I think it'll be really cool.
Well, thanks, man. That's I appreciate that.
And we'll keep an eye on it. I really want to thank you for talking with us today, Mike.
Oh, thank you, guys. It was a blast.
Yeah, it was great having you on the show. So unless you have anything else to say, Doug?
No, I think I'm good, other than just, Mike, it's been a fascinating conversation. Definitely a different take on things than what we've gotten in our other interviews. So I hope people take heart to some of the things you say, check out your stuff. Yeah, just thanks for being here.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much, and we'll see you next time on another Music Manumit.